Okay, turn in your Bibles, if you will, to Matthew chapter 17. Matthew chapter 17. We began this text last week, but we'll start with verse 1. Once again, it says, "And after 6 days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John, his brother," Peter, James, and John, his brother, should be said, "and bringeth them into the high mountain apart, and was transfigured before them, and his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as light. And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elijah talking with him. Then answered Peter and said unto Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If thou wilt, let us make here 3 tabernacles, one for thee, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. While he yet spake, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice out of the cloud which said, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased, hear ye him. And when the disciples heard it, they fell on their face and were sore afraid. And Jesus came and touched them and said, Arise and be not afraid. And when they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no man save Jesus." Now, we'll kind of just, we'll start with verse 5 in just a moment, but let me just remind you that that word transfigured in verse 2, just simply, it comes from the word we get metamorphosis from. It's to be changed into something, okay? And so we know that his whole countenance changed into his glorious, for lack of a better term, his glorious raiment. Now, were they seeing Jesus in his full glory? I don't think so, because I don't think they could have in their human bodies can endure that, okay? But they see a glimpse of his glory to the degree that it will be seen in heaven, I think is totally different. But our eyes and our ears and our bodies will be equipped to take in the glory of God at that point. But until then, they got a glimpse, and we're getting to read about it and get a little glimpse of it as well. Now, the fact that God manifest himself in the form of a bright cloud here is something that we can talk about today. It's kind of familiar, because if you'll remember back in the Old Testament, when they were wandering in the wilderness after their being freed from Egypt, that's how God would reveal himself or manifest himself, that he would be a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night, okay? If you look over in the book of Revelation chapter 14, John, in his revelation, saw Jesus sitting on a cloud with a sickle in his hand. That's a whole other story, but he was sitting on a cloud. And so this is a reoccurring thing, that there's some sort of involvement, whether it's a literal cloud or just the appearance of a cloud or whatever. We don't know, but there's a connection there. When Jesus comes in his glory, he'll come with the clouds. It tells us in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. And so it's pretty interesting. So in a very similar way, that's as he done in the past with the cloud, God overshadows Peter, James, and John, and with this loud voice saying in the second part of verse 5, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased, hear ye him." Now this too is familiar with us to us, because we remember when Jesus went had his baptism, when John the Baptist baptized him, back in Matthew chapter 3, verse 17, the words were just exactly the same. It says, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." The only thing that's different there is in chapter 3, God didn't say, "Hear ye him." He just said, "This is my Son, in whom I am well pleased." And so all of this is just one more confirmation of the deity of Christ. As we see all this transpiring here in this chapter, it's just God is not only saying, "This is my Son," which makes Jesus divine. It reveals his divine nature, but it also is God putting his stamp of approval on his Son, and his stamp of approval on everything Jesus is doing and everything he's going to do. In other words, God was saying, "He's my Son, and he's in perfect accord with me." So, and he says, "Hear ye him." That's his next words. And those words, that was a command to, obviously, to Peter, James, and John, because they're the ones there. But I think it's a command to all of us through the ages that would read this text. And it was a command that those three disciples needed very badly, because it's not that they didn't wholeheartedly believe Jesus, believe in Jesus, and believe his words. But if you'll remember, we just saw it in chapter 16, they were struggling with the idea of him dying. Remember, Peter said, hey, I'm not going to let this happen. And of course, Jesus had to rebuke him and say, get behind me, Satan. But it's just in their human frailty, they're just having a really difficult time understanding that this great leader, the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of God, is going to die. And they're just perplexed by that. So they've struggled with this. And so these words, in effect, is the Father saying, hey, if my son tells you he must go to Jerusalem and die, then believe him. If my son tells you that he's going to rise again on the third day, then believe him. And it's really a declaration of God just giving really a giant endorsement of his son and everything that he's doing. That's what's taking place here. And the disciples did just exactly the very appropriate thing. Peter don't always do the appropriate thing, but he did in this particular case. The scripture tells us that they fell on their face. It says, when the disciples heard it, they fell on their face and were sore afraid. Now, they obviously knew that they were standing in the awesome presence of Almighty God. They've seen the glory of Jesus, Son of God. They've heard the voice of God. They see the cloud that overshadowed them and all of this. And the natural thing for them to do would be just in absolute humility and subservience just to fall on their faces. I mean, I think there's occasions, and certainly it will when we stand before Jesus at the end of our life. I don't think there's any strength in us to stand. I think it's just the natural thing is to just fall face down in humility before him. And it says that they were sore afraid. That word afraid expresses the idea of reverence and awe. So it wasn't so much the fear, I'm sure there's an element of that, but it was really a godly fear of reverence and awe. And it says the word sore just means exceedingly. And so it could easily be read like this. They were in great awe and bowed in reverence. And that's essentially what took place there. And the Son of God responds to their humility. And this is very interesting. It's important for us to know it's always proper for us to be humble before God. Always. And no matter what the circumstances are, if we will humble ourselves before God, even when we've done wrong, and we will, okay, even when we've messed up big time, if we humble ourselves before God, He is, not to say there's not consequences, not to say that there's not some ramifications, some fallout from our mistakes, but we put ourselves at his mercy and we put ourselves in a position for him to do just what he does for Peter, James, and John. And they hadn't done anything wrong, by the way, but they have fell on their face in humility. And notice the response they get from him. And Jesus came and touched them and said, arise, be not afraid. Now that you just read that and you kind of think, well, he touched them. They said, get up, you guys, let's go. Don't be afraid. But no, it's really interesting to note that one of the intimations of the word touched is to fasten oneself to or attach to. Now stay with me here. I don't want to read anything into this, okay? I'm just going to throw this out there to you. It's not out of the question that Jesus actually embraced them, hugged them. Okay, with that, with the idea of attaching oneself to or fastening one, that the ideal to me is an embrace. Okay, am I saying that Jesus hugged them? I don't know, but there's so much power in the touch. There's power in words, we know that, but when you got the touch and the words, when you accompany your words of encouragement to somebody with a touch. It's reassuring words and a reassuring touch. It's really a powerful thing, and especially we have to be careful. I understand. I realize even me myself as a grown man, you have to be careful how you approach certain people, other women or that are not your wife or young children, things. I get all that, okay? And that's that. It's a, we've got to be conscientious of that. But as grown men, I think sometimes we're reluctant to show affection with the touch. And y'all say, man, you're sure a girly man today right here telling all this stuff. And I guess I am, okay. But I'm also a student of life. And life will teach you how to live if you can live long enough to learn it. And I've learned through life that it's so impactful sometimes when a person is vulnerable, a person is shattered or fragile, when you just, even if it's your arm around them, or just you know, grab their hand and say, you know, we're with you, we love you, it's going to be all right. There's something about that touch. And I'm a, y'all may or may not real, I'm by nature an affectionate person. And I can be rough around the edges, I know that. But by nature, I see the value in embracing people and speaking words of affirmation to them. And it's an undeniable fact that this is one of the most effective approaches to helping people get past a crisis, or to know that you can put one foot in front of the other, it's going to get better. Let me ask you this. If you have a crying baby, or you have a toddler that's fallen down, or you have a child that has just woke up from a nightmare, what are the two things you do? Number one, you hold them, do you not? Number two, you use words of comfort and encouragement. I mean, that's universal, right? And it crosses all boundaries. Every parent, grandparent, adult does that, okay? That's what, that we know by nature, that's what that child gets. Or what that child needs, and it's unanimously effective. Whoever does it, it's always effective. So I'll ask you the next question. Does that need go away when you mature and become an adult? It doesn't. Now, do we need, you know, to totally have somebody coddling us and holding us all the time? No, it's not that at all. We learn, we develop coping skills and this, that, and the other, but it's still a need. That's a very effective way of uplifting a person that is fragile at that particular moment. Now, I honestly say this, you know, there may be men here that fall in this category, but we men have kind of, sometimes we don't know how to do that, but it's important to learn. And, you know, if you don't learn, you'll probably get by fine. But sometimes I think we adults, especially men, we kind of have a little bit of a, we're not comfortable with that, so we're not going to do that. But if it's our children, especially our grandchildren or our wives, it's something that's important to do. And how I came up with that out of all of this, I was just so impressed by that when in my study of this, that they humbled themselves before Jesus. Okay, they fell on their face, which is always appropriate. And the response they got from him was some sort of affectionate touch. We know in the very least he touched them, okay? Whether it's a pat on the back, an arm around them, or an embrace, we don't know. But they got some touch out of Jesus. And then they got words of encouragement, says, arise. You know, it's almost like, hey, get up, it's gonna be all right. He said, be not afraid. I don't think Jesus just said that matter-of-factly. I think he embraced them, helped them to their feet, and said, don't be afraid, it's all right, I'm right here with you. You can get what you want out of that, but that's the way I see it. So let's begin in verse 8, and then we'll move on. We just have a little bit left here. It says, and when they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no man save Jesus only. And as they came down from the mountain, Jesus charged them, saying, tell this vision to no man until the Son of Man be risen from the dead. So with these three disciples having just seen the majesty of Jesus, along with seeing these preeminent leaders of the Old Testament, they saw Moses, they saw Elijah, they certainly, and you put yourself in their shoes, their first inclination would be to run down this mountain and tell everybody that they knew about what they just experienced. It would be for most any of us, okay? But Jesus cuts that off at the pass, and he tells them that you're going to have to keep this to yourself till after I have risen from the dead. Why would he command such a thing as that? It's not clear. The Bible doesn't say it, spell it out for us. But one of the possible reasons is this. We've discussed this many times before. The Jews of that day were, in fact, looking for and anticipating a Messiah that would conquer. They were looking for a military-minded man that would come on the scene and be their king, and that would get them out from under all the oppression of the Romans, that would deliver them from all their adversaries. And this is what they thought. And this is what the Jews still think today, okay? And this is what the disciples, as each one of them Jews, had thought before Jesus had begun to explain what he actually is. And so someone to take them to a level of victory, if you will. And so if they had known about what just took place on this mountain, if they had known that, hey, these three dependable, reliable, believable fellas, Peter, James, and John, just saw Elijah and Moses and Jesus talking. Can you imagine what that would have done? There's just been a powwow, if you will, on the mountain between these two oaths, one representing the law, Moses, and the other representing the prophets, that's Elijah, and Jesus, the Son of God, talking. There's no doubt that that would have lit a fire in the Jews, and they would have began to probably take measures to get this uprising going, to get this revolt, if you will, against Rome going, potentially taking steps to coronate Jesus as their king. And all of this is not according to God's plan. As you well know, it's not what needed to happen. And because that is not the kind of Messiah Jesus was or is. He's the Christ, but he comes meek and humble, soft-spoken, powerful, yes, can do anything he wants, but he wasn't there to deliver them from political bondage. He was there to deliver them from their sins, and by the way, he still is. He's not there to conquer Rome, but he was there to conquer death. You see, and so everything about that would go contrary to the plan of God. Is that the reason he told them not to say anything? I don't know, but it sure makes sense to me. So the best way to keeping things going in the right direction was for his disciples to, hey, you guys keep this under your hat until I've died on the cross and I rise again, and then you can tell what you want. And it's interesting to say, when you go ahead and read the book of Peter, he talks about this very thing. He couldn't wait to tell somebody, and so he wrote it down in his epistle about this very day, okay? And so there's that. We'll come together next week. We'll pick up in verse 9 and see where that takes us, okay? Appreciate you guys being here tonight, being faithful. We'll go ahead and stand, and you guys be praying hard. Pray for our services on Sunday as we continue with this series of End Times. And we've really been having some good crowds, and so y'all invite somebody, come back yourself, and we'll see you then, okay? All right. Stacy, will you lead us in prayer, please, sir?